Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is United Food and Commercial Workers Fund against Walgreens. Mr. Cafferty.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Patrick Cafferty, and I represent the plaintiff, UFCW. And this is our appeal from a decision dismissing our RICO complaint against defendants Walgreens and Parr. Plaintiff alleges that defendants engaged in a prescription-switching scheme that caused third-party payers such as UFCW to overpay for generic versions of two popular drugs, ranitidine, which is the generic version of Zantac, and fluoxetine, which is the generic version of Prozac. As the briefs indicate, this is the second appeal before this Court arising out of these same underlying circumstances. 2 years ago this month, a panel of this Court that included Judge Mannion issued a decision that affirmed the dismissal of a complaint against Walgreens asserted by a small health benefit fund, not the same plaintiff here. But this case is different from Pirelli for two important reasons. First of all, in the Pirelli decision, the Court explained how third-party payer prescription data should be analyzed to determine whether reimbursements for the inexpensive forms of the drug were outstripped by reimbursements for the expensive forms of the drug in an unlikely way. And here, UFCW has broken down its data in that manner, and it demonstrates in Exhibit 26 of the complaint, and it's expressed in graphs and tables throughout the complaint, how UFCW was harmed by this prescription switching. And this data corroborates the allegations that there's been a prescription switching scheme.
So let me draw your attention. And there are a number of things that are at issue, of course. But the thing that I would appreciate your addressing is how your complaint adequately alleges that Parr and Walgreens were conducting the affairs of an enterprise, which is obviously essential for a RICO theory.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The district court held that we failed to allege an enterprise. In our 1962C counts, there's count one against Parr and count one against Walgreens and count two against Parr. We alleged an association, in fact, enterprise consisting of Walgreens, Parr, and key personnel from both companies. One of the documents attached to the complaint, Exhibit 7, which is supplemental appendix or separate appendix number 119, they refer to themselves as the Walgreens-Parr HRP, Health Resource Partnership.
So is your theory essentially that they were a de facto joint venture for this purpose?
They had a partnership for this purpose, and their documents talk about the partnership for the ranitidine program and for the fluoxetine program, and I believe it's Exhibit 22 to the complaint where they talk about they're sure they can find other programs to collaborate on in the future.
Now, can you explain how what they were doing was somehow something different from what each would have done independently if the other had never existed?
Yes, Your Honor. That feeds into what the district court held, that the district court held they were conducting their own affairs and not the affairs of the enterprise. But the combination of the two led them into matters that went well beyond their own affairs. For example, Parr, as a generic manufacturer, became heavily involved in manipulating the substitution of generic drugs at the retail level. Its personnel even prepared an analysis of Walgreens' business, and that's
So is your idea that Parr simply would not have manufactured, I realize that it flips for the two drugs, but as many capsules of the one or as many tablets of the other had it not been for this arrangement?
There would not have been a market. Well, speaking of ranitidine, which is the tablets are the cheap ones and the capsules are the expensive ones, there wouldn't have been a market for the capsules if there hadn't been this prescription switching scheme.
So and Parr was capable of manufacturing either format of the drug?
Sure. If they got FDA approval, I believe they did. But yeah, once a drug is off patent and any generic manufacturer that gets FDA approval can make it, and for popular drugs like Zantac and Prozac, there's huge markets for these drugs, and once they go generic, they become highly competitive.
Right.
And that's when, once they become competitive, third-party payers and the government adopt, they review the market and determine the most that they will pay for the drug.
So a competitor wouldn't put on the market a really expensive thing that pharmacies such as Walgreens or others would have to pay a lot of money for unless there was some assurance that that expensive thing could be sold downstream.
I agree. It'd be unlikely they would do that if they couldn't make money on it. And there was not a competitive market for ranitidine for the capsules. And so it was why they engaged in the switching scheme. And that one of the key documents that lays out how this was done is Exhibit 2 to the complaint, which is Supplemental Appendix, page 33. And it's a document, and this feeds into what I was getting into about PAR dealing with the affairs beyond itself. But this is a PAR vice president of sales prepares this document that explains to Walgreens how it can make $80 million a year instead of $5 million a year on ranitidine.
But in the meantime, is there any evidence or is there any indication in the complaint that PAR also was making more money by selling the capsule form of ranitidine or the tablet form of fluoxetine to Walgreens?
Well, in that
their profit margin higher than it was with the
absolutely. Well, first of all, there wouldn't have been a market for the drug in the first place. If they were making the ranitidine.
Right, but if they were getting the same return.
In that document I just referred to, the Exhibit 2, it explains how Walgreens can make $80 million instead of $5 million. And it's not because PAR was proposing a better product that doctors and patients would prefer, and it's not because they're proposing better pricing. In fact, if you look at that document, they're proposing to charge Walgreens five times more for their ranitidine capsules than Walgreens was paying its current supplier of ranitidine tablets, which I believe was Mylan.
And so your inference is that that higher price that PAR was charging wasn't just reflective of higher costs of formulating it in the
absolutely
different
form. Absolutely
not. It was profit.
What they were proposing in that document is a switching scheme to sell a drug, to switch drug from that's in a competitive market to a drug that's not in a competitive market. And the drugs that are in the competitive market have a maximum allowable cost that are adopted by government agencies, by third-party payers, by pharmacy benefit managers, because there's competition and they can look at the market and determine the appropriate price for those, and they tell the pharmacies, this is the most we will pay for that drug. Drugs that aren't in a competitive market are priced based on a list price, which is made by the manufacturer, and there's discounts offered and so forth, but it's not a competitive price.
But what makes this wrongful for these relationships and switchings and so forth to occur is a regulatory violation, isn't it?
That is what the district court held. I would disagree with that. I would agree that
that's good. That was the point of my question.
Yeah, I agree that it likely is a regulatory violation. But it's also a violation to the extent it's false and misleading. It's making misrepresentations to third-party payers that prescriptions are being filled as written. Now, the case that
and
I think you'll...
And the misleading part, you're saying, is mail fraud and wire fraud, is
yes,
that right?
they're transmitting information over the networks. The representation that's coming through the PBM to the third-party payers is that this prescription has been filled as it was written.
But we have Seventh Circuit precedent that says that we look with at least skepticism, maybe disfavor, on using mail fraud and wire fraud as the predicate crimes for RICO. Isn't that true?
It is. It's certainly not the most favored approach, but
yeah.
But it's not prohibited either. And I think we've got enough details in this case.
Why do you think there's a reticence about it in the Seventh Circuit precedent? What makes the Seventh Circuit arch an eyebrow about that?
Well, RICO, you know, it's been designed, has been interpreted as applying to organized crime, and to the extent that it's being applied against legitimate businesses, that raises an eyebrow. But to the extent that we're able to plead and establish that they have violated these provisions, and I think the complaint here, construed in the light most favorable to plaintiff, we're only at a motion to dismiss stage here, and construing those allegations in the light most favorable to plaintiff, there's enough in the complaint to satisfy that it's more than just a regulatory violation.
It is a regulatory violation, but
likely,
more than that, you say.
Yes, absolutely.
If you took the regulatory violation out of it, if it were cricket under the FDCA rules, would you still have a case?
I would say yes. The way I think you look at it is a Venn diagram of the two intersecting circles. One of them is violation of FDA regulations, and the other one's violation of, you know, mail fraud or wire fraud. And to the extent that there's overlap between the two, it would be a violation of either. It could, you know, false statement or misleading statement could be violative of mail or wire fraud and not be an FDA violation. In this context, I think it likely is an FDA violation because Exhibit 2 to the complaint is an FDA letter that says you cannot substitute capsules for tablets. And I think the case that illustrates the point the best is the Epogen case. That involved off-label marketing. Pharmaceutical companies are allowed to market drugs only for purposes that have been approved by the FDA. Doctors can prescribe drugs for any reason they want, but pharmaceutical companies can't market them for off-label uses. And what the Epogen court held was that to the extent that the plaintiff alleges that false and misleading off-label marketing, that could violate both the FDA and RICO. But to the extent that there was honest, truthful off-label marketing, that would only violate the FDA. It wouldn't violate anything else. Drawing a comparison with this circumstance is if they were substituting capsules for tablets but did so in an openly and honest way, there probably wouldn't be a violation of RICO. But that's not what we allege. We allege that they were clandestinely switching the prescriptions and transmitting the information that they were being filled as they were written by the physicians.
And so can I ask a question relating to that? Because that reminds me of the timeliness argument that your opponents have raised. Presumably somewhere in your records, and you've now found them for purposes of this complaint, you can see that there was a suspicious number of substitutions of, you know, capsules for ranitidine and tablets for the fluoxetine. So I guess I'm interested in a couple of things. Why shouldn't you have found this sooner? And what percentage of your overall business is this? Is this just something that was so tiny that you wouldn't have caught it with a normal monitoring system?
I would agree that it is very tiny in the scheme of things. And the district court did hold that because we had these records in our possession that we were somehow on notice. But as this court's opinion in Fujisawa indicates, mere access to records is not a basis to start the statute of limitations running unless...
Did you have records of the prescription or of just what was filled?
There are large spreadsheets that have... It indicates the drugs that are filled. And there was involving for ranitidine and fluoxetine.
I'm asking an important question because before you know that there's been a substitution, you'd have to know what the doctor said and what was filled. And I understood you to be arguing that it's actually Walgreens that retains the doctor's script.
That's
you have what was filled. But if you only have what was filled, you don't know if the doctor said, for this patient, I'd like a capsule.
That's absolutely correct. The third-party payer is only getting transactional data that says how the prescription was filled.
That's just half of the equation, and for all anybody knows, that might be fine. I'm just wondering whether there's any signal in the records about that.
No, there was not. And the key to the Fujisawa case is that there has to be something that triggers the duty to look into this.
Was this a deal just with Walgreens? I mean, were other pharmacies involved too, like CVS or somebody else?
There was a QI-TAM settlement with CVS. I don't believe it involved PAR, and that was just for ranitidine. And the documents attached to the complaint indicate that PAR was actually marketing this program to other retailers. But this case is actually focused just on PAR and Walgreens. And also
was the government's QI-TAM case? Well, I mean, the government has a big QI-TAM case against Walgreens. It's, of course, what reveals to you when that complaint is unsealed what's going on.
That's correct, and that's what we're saying is the first red flag that would start a statute of limitations running, giving us an inquiry duty. And that was in June 2008 when it became public that Walgreens settled a claims that it was defrauding Medicaid on these drugs, and they settled for $35 million. And the other point I'd like to make is in the Pirelli decision, what Judge Mannion was on that panel where we are instructed to undertake this analysis to determine if there's been fraud. And that's the purpose of undertaking the analysis is to confirm suspicion. It's not a matter of due diligence. This is not the kind of thing that would be a due diligence. It's not like the property tax bill case that was relied upon defendants. This is something that was very difficult to figure out. You have to have a reason to think that comparing prescriptions between pharmacies would yield something. And this is also, statute of limitations is an affirmative defense that can be applied on a motion to dismiss only when the plaintiff essentially pleads itself out of court.
Was this a dismissal with prejudice?
Yes. And I would point out that in the complaint we had specific allegations about the discovery rule and tolling the statute of limitations, so I'd respectfully submit that we didn't plead ourselves out of court. Whether we could survive it as a matter of fact is something that should have been litigated rather than decided summarily on a motion to dismiss.
If it hadn't been a dismissal with prejudice, would you be able to recraft your claim?
We would consider it. I'm not sure. I thought we pretty much put everything we had in this complaint.
So I understand that. Okay.
In addition to the pattern, I'm interested in addition to the enterprise, the pattern of racketeering, with the continuity and what went on after this initial, we'll call it agreement, you call it some kind of a, I'm not familiar with this partnership that you referred to, but sort of an enterprise. But as far as the pattern that continued, why is that not missing in this case?
Judge Mannion, we've alleged what is called closed-ended continuity, which is when a scheme has ended, and the district court relied on a number of factors from the Morgan versus Waukegan Bank case that are non-dispositive factors, and it held that because we alleged two similar schemes with similar predicate acts over a concurrent period of 3 years, that this was insufficient. But I think he sold us short on the 3 years. And cases such as this court's Fujisawa opinion emphasize a distinction between multiple predicate acts that further one large fraud, which is less conducive to a finding of continuity, and multiple predicate acts that cause multiple injuries to multiple victims, which is more conducive to a finding of continuity. And this case is of the latter nature, because every time there's a transmission over the PBM networks that a particular drug has been prescribed and they pay for it, that's a separate injury to a separate entity.
It's a continuity with the enterprise. That's what I'm looking at, right?
Okay. And then our continuity with the enterprise, when the other cases also talk about when a case has a natural ending point and when it met with a fortuitous end. And this is a case that met with a fortuitous end because in 2004 they realized that they were being scrutinized by the government and they unwound the program quietly, in the words of Walgreens. And in fact, Walgreens was projecting profits based on the scheme continuing, and through negotiations with PAR, they were able to mitigate those lost profits, which certainly suggests a partnership beyond an ordinary buyer-seller relationship. And it also indicates that neither of them expected that the scheme would end when it did, and that supports closed-end continuity.
And if you want to save a minute for your rebuttal.
I would like to save a minute for my rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Andelman.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Andelman. I represent Walgreen Company. PAR has ceded its time, so I'm speaking for both defendants today when I ask that the Court affirm the judgment of the District Court. I'd like to first take up this issue of the statute of limitations and whether or not UFCW was on notice inquiry.
But, of course, you do have a bit of a problem in that we've tolerated 12b-6 statute of limitations dismissals, but if you are a rules purist, you look and you see it's an 8C that the statute of limitations comes up. So I think there's a bit of a burden to toss it on the face of a complaint only.
I agree, and it's for the unusual case. I just think this is one of those cases that falls under that umbrella.
But why, given the discovery allegations? Because, as I was saying, if both sides of the equation were publicly available, what did the doctor write, what was filled, then I could certainly see a duty of diligence in reviewing one's records. But we all understand that doctors are actually entitled to check a box saying don't substitute with a generic at all. much less various forms of the generic. So I'm, and Walgreens retains those.
Here's my response to that, Your Honor. This isn't just random records you have to rifle through your files and figure it out. These are actually invoices or payments.
Well, I understand. And so why would you know it was wrong to have it?
Suddenly, well, they take their allegations. They say that Walgreens is about 40% of the prescriptions in for them that they reimburse. It's a significant part of two significant drugs, ranitidine and fluoxetine. They say that over the relevant period they paid $100,000 in reimbursements, and they say that that was 3 to 4 times as much as they would have paid for the other dosage form.
But that's why I asked, and I know there's something in the record about this, what these two, these are not the only two drugs that Walgreens dispenses, and they're not the only two drugs, I mean, obviously, Walgreens is huge, and they're not the only two drugs that this benefits fund supports. They support the entirety of the drugs that the 15,000 families needed, whatever number of people that turns out to be. So I'm not sure it's one of those plain as the nose in your face sort of things where you see an
increase.
Because
the point I was going to make is that they also put in their complaint that in the period right before July of 2001, between January of 2000 and May 31 of 2001, they were filling prescriptions for these same two drugs, or I guess I'm using the ranitidine example, and it was all 100% tablets in that instance.
But, you know,
then
the other pharmacies were probably still ordering tablets.
Well, they were still ordering both, actually. Osco sold a bunch of the par dosage form. A lot of drug stores did. It's not true that there wasn't a market. But the real point is
just not much of a one.
Well, the graph says that there was still a substantial number being sold by Osco, and there were still some being sold by others. And par wasn't the only one manufacturing this drug. If you look at Exhibit 10, which is after Walgreens decided to cease the cross-reference, there's an email that says we need to go back and negotiate a price reduction. It's not just from Par, it's also from Teva, which is another generic manufacturer that made the exact same drug. But the real point on limitations period is these aren't random records. This is what you paid. So if suddenly what you paid tripled or quadrupled 1 month to the next, I think that puts you on notice. And the argument that, well, we fill too many prescriptions is, in essence, that the bigger and the more sophisticated you are as a company, the less responsible you are for knowing what you paid. Because any business should know that if suddenly their prices increase 3 to 4 times on a month-to-month basis, there's all kinds of computer programs, there's all kinds of basic economic controls that are in place that should be like, huh, why am I suddenly paying to this one pharmacy?
About what is common in the industry, about what these programs are. I mean, it's very easy for you to hypothesize, but doesn't that sound more like 8C and summary judgment?
I don't think so, because, you see, they can't have it both ways. They say, in the beginning of this
complaint, both ways.
They say that what renders their complaint sufficiently specific is the same pattern that they say in their briefs and in their complaint was shocking and surprising, right, in the prescription
fills. Once you focus on it, that, you know, if you had a random check system in place, something that's accounting for 1% of your prescriptions might not pop up in a random thing.
In my view, I think a company is responsible to know what it's paying. Maybe not to know what random records show, but if suddenly your costs increase 3 to 4 times, I don't think it's a good excuse under Byrne-Phelps and similar cases in other jurisdictions to say, I didn't know what I was paying. I'm just too big. I can't be responsible for that.
Well, but you don't know what the doctor's slip said. You are relying on the integrity of the pharmacy to fill as according to the prescription. I mean, I guess under the world that you like, you have to assume that all pharmacies are lying, which is a little troublesome.
No, just that there has to be an explanation. But in any event, Your Honor, let me move on to the RICO issues.
Sure.
With regard to Enterprise in particular, I think that the complaint utterly fails.
Sure. It reminds me of antitrust. Of course, RICO is a cousin of the antitrust cases, and the Clayton Act is in many ways a model. Neither Walgreens nor Parr acting alone could have done this. It required the actions of both of them. Parr had to manufacture a form that wouldn't have sold in the market, wouldn't have sold in a competitive generic market, and Walgreens had to engage in this surreptitious switching.
Your Honor, there's no pleaded facts, no facts at all to support that conclusion.
There's pleaded facts that it's essentially, you know, a partnership.
No, I don't. Teva manufactured these drugs. Other manufacturers also did these same dosage forms. What's alleged in the complaint is that a few manufacturers made these, who aren't alleged to have been part of this.
It's also alleged that CVS... But you have everyone in the market involved in these things, any more than you have to have everyone in the market involved in a price-fixing conspiracy. They're always side companies.
But the premise can't be, well, could be, I suppose, but they have not alleged that any facts to support the notion that Parr wouldn't have made this dosage form, but for Walgreens... decision in July of 2001.
But there's economic common sense. You know, if you make a lot of things that cost 10 times as much as what your competitors are selling, you're not going to have a market unless you have somebody who's agreed to buy these expensive things.
Others bought them. CVS bought
not
them.
At the rate that Walgreens did.
That we don't. There's no evidence in this record to support that conclusion. CVS had the exact same Keytam case. It's all public record. They paid tens of millions of dollars. Walgreens had a Keytam case. Osco Drug filled lots of them. In this record, on this complaint, Parr made the same pitch to Caremark. They made the same pitch to Amerisource. It's just not true. It imports things from outside this record to suggest that if Walgreens hadn't agreed to market these drugs, that they wouldn't have been made. There's no support for that.
I think there's some of the exhibits, I'm not finding them right now, so I'm not going to waste time looking.
In fact, with regard to fluoxetine, which they claim these marketing pitches constituted the meeting, they don't have one marketing pitch to Walgreens. All the exhibits to this complaint are to CVS, Amerisource, and Caremark, other pharmacies that did the exact same thing.
But the complaint alleges that Walgreens, alleges, I mean, again, 12b-6, the complaint alleges that Walgreens and Parr get together and they create a partnership that does something that would not have been sustainable in an open competitive market.
Let me address that. What they allege is that there was these meetings that took place in the spring of 2001 that we say really was just a marketing pitch. At those meetings, what they say happened is that Parr attempted to mislead Walgreens. That's their words. That they attempted to mislead us. In paragraph, they say then we agreed. Paragraph 89 of the complaint says, as Parr intended, Walgreens then communicated those misrepresentations about the regulations to its pharmacists.
Okay, and so let's just stop for a moment. Because there might be plenty of blame to spread. So maybe Parr is the one that misrepresents the regulations and makes Walgreens think that there's a loophole, let's say, in the reimbursement system that's going to be very lucrative to exploit. Okay. That doesn't justify Walgreens then going on and telling its pharmacists disregard what the doctor prescribed.
That is specifically the opposite of what the exhibits show we said. Because if you look at the exhibits, and I think it's... might be Exhibit 9 or 10, but it's the email we cited in our brief that Walgreens sent to its pharmacist. It's very clear that you have to follow the regulations and you have to call the doctors and get permission. And then
so
if you look at the emails...
Like trying a case based on of exhibits to 12B, to a complaint?
No, they've incorporated those exhibits, so now they're part of the complaint, so they can't rely on inferences that are inconsistent with them. But if I could, Your Honor, the real issue is that after that marketing pitch... After that happened in 2001, there is not a single allegation of joint conduct, communications, or anything other than either of these companies doing their own business. Now, they may not like...
The back end. They say when they suddenly realize that the attention of the federal government is on this, there's a cooperative effort to back out of it.
That's not all they allege.
They say that.
No, they
say it repeatedly in their briefs.
I understand they keep
so
saying
don't
that.
Tell me they don't say it. You know, you can say it's wrong if you want.
I can say they argue it, but if you then go look at the actual facts that they allege, they base that entirely on an email. And I think this is Exhibit 10 that says, Walgreens are going to discontinue doing this. You, executive at Walgreens, go negotiate with Parr and Teva now. to get lower prices. That doesn't show joint conduct. All that shows is that an executive at Walgreens told another executive at Walgreens, go try to reduce our costs. There's nothing unusual or nefarious about that. They want to draw the conclusion that there is, but you had a three-year period when there was no contact, when all that was happening is Walgreens was filling prescriptions. They don't like the way we fill them. Okay? Before, they had a claim against us on that. That got dismissed. PAR was making a legal drug and selling it. They weren't involved in the prescriptions. And if you look at what the underlying predicates are the Walgreens pharmacists at the 7,000 drugstores inputting into a computer this prescription at this dosage form.
And according to the allegations, it switches over from capsule to tablet, tablet to capsule. And I guess my concern is you're taking a divide-and-conquer approach toward the facts that are alleged in the complaint. We're in this crazy mixed-up world where nobody knows how much factual detail is necessary, how much is too much, you know, and so we'll just assume that there needs to be a lot in this complaint because of the 9B overtone to it and the underlying offenses. But I think you can take any individual fact alone and say, oh, this is just innocuous. It's adding them up that's a little different.
But what adds up to show that during the actual predicates, during the filling of the prescriptions, there was joint conduct or an enterprise or something? Well, this court has said repeatedly, based on U.S. Supreme Court precedent, that there has to be an enterprise meaningfully distinct from the entities.
Absolutely.
And what they're asking, in essence, is anytime two companies make an agreement of some kind, and then one of those companies does something they don't agree with, in this case Walgreens, the way they filled the prescription, that's an enterprise. What is it that is meaningfully distinct? They point to a PowerPoint, which is actually an internal PAR PowerPoint, where they happen to label something, not only as to one of the drugs, the Walgreens PAR partnership. That's marketing speak. There's no allegation that actual participation by PAR during the three-year period that's at issue in any of the predicates, in filling prescriptions. They didn't have any role in that.
We
were doing our business and they were doing theirs.
Suppose they had gotten together and decided to fix prices in some way. You would agree that that was separate from Walgreens. I mean, you know, there are lots of times where joint ventures are created between two companies and the joint venture is separate from either of the individual participants.
If it was an agreement in parallel conduct, if this was an antitrust case, then on their theory, every antitrust case is a RICO case, effectively.
No, I'm obviously not saying that, but I'm just focusing only on this enterprise element. Is there something separate from enterprise in fact, which is a theory that the Supreme Court has recognized? We don't have to have them filing articles of incorporation somewhere. It can be pragmatic. So I guess I'm just worried about the economic self-interest of each of them not being to act this way unless you're acting together.
There were other manufacturers and there were other pharmacies.
But why does that relate to their economic interest?
Well, our economic interest is obviously to be reimbursed as much as we can. We owe that to our shareholders. And PAR's economic interest is to manufacture and sell. But
and
their allegation
is, what if the only way to achieve that is by lying to the market?
Well, you have to have some plausibility, I think, in the theory. So they started manufacturing this drug.
And why isn't the government's key TAM action a suggestion of some plausibility in this theory?
Well, because the government didn't rely on a RICO.
They didn't have to. I'm saying why. You said why would they behave that way? The government, of course, as a big payor for prescription drugs, had an interest, and they did it in the key TAM action. But
the
if
fact
you're looking
government,
for a motivation to behave this way, the government's case suggests that there was.
I think the unproven allegations in a case that was settled, I don't think, are a basis. And, in fact, this court held in Pirelli are not a basis to say that they have a plausible legal theory. And with regard to this notion that they would never have made these drugs but for Walgreens agreeing, they were making these drugs in 2000. The document he was talking about, Exhibit 2, where they did the analysis of how much Walgreens could make, internal PAR documents dated November 2000, before any meeting with Walgreens. They were already making this drug. They didn't make this drug because a year after they started making it, Walgreens agreed with their marketing pitch.
But you're eliding the quantity question. Sure, maybe everybody makes a little bit of both form, but the quantity question is crucial.
Well, they were more successful, but where's the even an agreement to break the law, an allegation to break the law? That this is a RICO case. They need to show mail fraud. They need to plead criminal. Then they ultimately would need to prove criminal intent.
But no,
how can you prove criminal
that.
Intent when what you've pleaded is that one of the parties misled the others and the other was duped? And then both companies went off and conducted their own business affairs.
You're pleading that Walgreens is duped. I just don't see that in the pleading.
Paragraph 89, Walgreens then repeated it. I mean, I could go back, Your Honor, and provide probably four or five different instances where they say they misled us. They attached expert reports to the complaint. It wasn't like they came in and said, let's break the law. Why, if they were going to do that, why did they have an expert? Exhibits 15, 16, and 17 of the complaint. Parr hired an expert to say this is lawful. This can be done appropriately. This is a loophole that's appropriate and you can take advantage of it. How is that plausible in the context of a criminal conspiracy or agreement? What they're doing here is they're taking a classically round peg and putting it in a square hole. This is not a RICO case. You know, and Mr. Cafferty stood up and he argued, well, we did what the court said in Pirelli to do by doing the statistical analysis. But Pirelli was an ICFA case, an Illinois Consumer Fraud Act case. And the pleading was very different.
Well, they have pleaded mail fraud and wire fraud with constant dishonest transmissions over the wires and through the mails of prescriptions that were actually for tablets that got filled with capsules.
Entirely on information and belief, because he said today he has no idea what they were prescribed for. The first paragraph of this complaint says...
No, he said he didn't until the government case was...
If you look at what he's pleaded, though, the very first sentence of this complaint is, or first paragraph of this complaint says, everything in this complaint is information and belief, based on the QI-TAM allegations, other than what we personally, what UFCW itself did, meaning
you
its payment.
Makes me think there's some district courts that are starting to allow pre-12B6 discovery, which is a little oxymoronic from the point of view of the 1938 rules drafters, but it seems to me that's essentially what you're arguing for. There should be a rule permitting pre-12B6 discovery.
Really? What we're really arguing is that this case... It's not a treble damages case. It's not, it's not an appropriate case for RICO. And what they're asking the court to do is something pretty extraordinary, I think, because they're asking the court to open up a national class action that would require discovery over 7,000 pharmacies going back more than a decade now. I still think that there's no excuse for how long they waited on this. And they want to do it with really a new, broader construction of RICO than this court certainly has ever approved before.
I'm not sure post-Walmart. You're jumping ahead of yourself on the class action point.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's appropriate, given what they're asking, that they be held to the pleading standards. And this is a 9B case. I'm not going to have time to talk about the lack of particularity. But this complaint doesn't plead with particularity. And just to get to one of the points that Judge Barker made, if the FDA, if this was all appropriate and lawful, if Parr was right and UFCW is wrong about that, then nothing's illegal. Because what was transmitted, it's me telling myself I'm out of time.
That's very diligent of you.
What was transmitted, they don't plead any particulars about that. And they obviously have that. And they know exactly what we transmitted to ask for payment. It didn't say Dr. X prescribed this. It just said this was filled with this,
right.
You know, and so they're assuming that we must have switched. But if it was lawful, then it's just a regular. Then where's the crime? Nothing's unlawful. Nothing was inappropriate. It was an appropriate substitution. And when I look at the expert that Parr gave us, indicates that, you know, in most states, this was completely appropriate and within the discretion of the pharmacist. Thank you. I appreciate your patience.
Certainly. I will give you an extra, so you only have 2 minutes, Mr. Cafferty, since I think that more or less balances things.
Well, the first point I'd like to make is this is a complaint. Mr. Andelman was asking for all kinds of evidence during a three-year period. We haven't had any discovery in this case. The only evidence we have is what we've been able to get from the public record, which is
but
the key.
But you do have a burden of pleading under 9B with specificity.
Absolutely. And we've dug up all that we can without discovery. But Rule 9B, there's a number of cases in the Seventh Circuit that talk about how you can't ask the plaintiff to plead the impossible. And we simply don't have correspondence between Parr and Walgreens for a three-year period without any kind of discovery.
What about this Walgreens was duped theory?
I don't think I agree with that. They marketed it to them. Walgreens certainly understood what they were doing. There's a number of exhibits that talk about their collaboration for this.
But isn't it important what they were doing, parenthesis, illegally, or what they were doing, parenthesis, within a loophole in the law?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
I mean, I'm just saying, if Walgreens knew what it was doing because Parr said, hey, we have a great strategy, you know, for making money, and we found a loophole that allows us to do that, I'm not sure where your case is. Walgreens independently do that was wrong.
If Walgreens independently knew it was wrong, I believe they did independently know
what
it was wrong.
What did they independently do that was wrong? What?
They substituted dosage forms in a manner that was not appropriate and misrepresented that fact.
And not appropriate how? You know, because the doctor didn't say so?
Correct.
Because
the
FDA says no bioequivalence?
That's correct, too.
So we take as a given anything the FDA has done. That's why we're not worried about regulations.
I agree with that.
And then we say, what did you do?
Yes, and in terms of conducting the enterprise, every time Walgreens filled a prescription at the pharmacy counter, as it was written by the doctor, they were conducting their own affairs. But every time they switched prescriptions, they were conducting the affairs of the enterprise that we've alleged.
You know, I swear, I just keep coming back to this enterprise. I know I don't say much here, but it seems to me that this, you referred to something about, I wrote down HRP partnership or something?
That was one of the documents that referred to the health resource partnership between Walgreens and Parr. There are other documents that talk about their partnership, Exhibit 22.
But that's what you're talking about as the enterprise. And then you say there's that as far as the pattern of racketeering, it's closed end. Therefore, all the pattern of racketeering is within that time period, apparently. Right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and I guess my problem is that once this sort of understanding is done, if here's what they're going to do, then Walgreens goes ahead and does it until they find that the federal government's sniffing around, and then they stop. I don't understand where this continuity within this closed-end period or the more precise, I think, distinct, whatever you call it, meaningful, whatever you want to call it, enterprise. That just doesn't seem to fit here. I can understand if there really were some, I don't know what you would call it, some distinct group that's going back and forth and they're interacting, and you put every time you fill a prescription, that's not interaction. That's just dealing with the customer.
Again, we haven't had discovery or anything, so.
I know.
I would refer the court to the Jackson versus Sedgwick case in the Sixth Circuit, which is cited in our reply brief. It was decided after our opening brief, but the enterprise there is very comparable to the one that we've alleged here, and that was upheld. That involved Coca-Cola and its third-party workers' compensation administrator defrauding Coca-Cola employees out of workers' compensation benefits. And I don't have time to get into the whole case, but I would refer the court to that.
Any further questions?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.